Welcome to Energy in Action. I'm your host, Marcy Young, and as a Mito patient myself, I appreciate you and the community you've helped us to build. This podcast honors the triumphs and struggles of patients and families affected by this disease and celebrates the work being done by doctors and researchers every day to make it a safer world for our people. We are a support group and a podcast focusing on all things related to mitochondrial disease. Welcome to another episode of Energy in Action. We are joined today by Devin. We brought her back to talk about some new concepts that have not been discussed on Energy in Action, but I think they're really important. I think it's important to talk about genetics and a genetic counselor and the importance of it and a lot of things that go along with that. So, Devin, thank you so much for being here. Again, thanks for being such a big part of our show in 2025. You've been on so many times, and we really, really appreciate your presence and your energy.
It's so nice to talk to you. Like, I was just thinking, I was like, wait, this is the last one. I won't get to see her again soon.
We'll come up with more. So for our listeners, we did put together like a list of topics for Devin, and this we're actually on our final recording of our initial plan, but don't fear, we'll find some more opportunities for Devin. I think what's important about this episode is every single episode, whether I'm talking to a researcher, a patient, a physician, the concept comes up about this extensive diagnostic journey. And I understand it myself, and we know that we all understand this concept too. But today we're going to talk about what happens after that journey. Sometimes the journey ends in a genetic diagnosis, and other times it doesn't. And we're going to talk about both scenarios. I'm always glad there is no video with these podcast episodes, but maybe a flow chart would be nice with this one, but we'll make do. So, you know, kind of taking it back to my history, right after I got my genetic diagnosis, or maybe during the process, I was connected with a lovely genetic counselor at the Cleveland Clinic, and it worked in tandem with my neurologist as I was, you know, becoming diagnosed. After I met with her a few times, she left the clinic, and then I never ended up connecting with another genetic counselor. I have always seen a neurologist, but when I got involved in Mito Action, I started hearing more and more people talk about their relationships with the genetic counselor. So it's kind of stopped me in my tracks and made me think, like, should I continue to see one? So Devin, talk to us a little bit about after the genetic diagnosis, why should a mitochondrial disease patient, or really anyone with a genetic, maybe a rare disease, see a genetic counselor after the fact?
Yeah, no, it's a really great question. A lot of people ask about that. And I always laugh because for me, with my diagnostic journey, I didn't see a genetic counselor till after I was diagnosed. And so everyone's like, oh, is that how you heard about the field? I was like, nope, I didn't know it existed until I became one. And then I saw one later. Like, it's not how I discovered it. But I think I always like to start by saying, like, well, what really is a GC? Like, what is a genetic counselor? Because I think a lot of people think that we're a geneticist, but it's a little different. So genetic counselor, GC for short, is a master's degree. So it's a 2 or 3 year program where you only learn about genetics, what different types of genetic changes you have, what conditions it can cause, how do we learn more about them, how do they impact people's lives, what kind of family dynamics come up in it, what kind of psychosocial stuff, like how do you feel when you get an answer or you don't get an answer. So it's a very different type of training. I didn't have to go to med school. I am so glad I never have to go near anyone with a needle. I have a needle phobia. I'm like, luckily that's your job. You go do that. I'll just talk to people. But it is interesting, I think, because with a genetic counselor, a lot of people meet them in the context of testing only, right? So like your doctor's like, I want to order a genetic test. This genetic counselor is going to come in and tell you what the test is, consent you for it, and then walk you through results on the back end. Other people will meet a genetic counselor to take a family history. Like you get that a lot when people are pregnant. It's like, oh, they made me meet with a GC once. They drew a family tree, talked to me about Down syndrome screening, and I never heard from them again if I didn't do testing. So a lot of people, they interact with us around the test to get it or to talk about it afterwards. But there's a lot of different things that we can do in those conversations. So for me, let's say that you're one of us that found a genetic answer. We're lucky enough to do so. One, what they tell you when you get that answer is just based on current knowledge. And the reality is, we will forever know the least amount about genetics that we do at any point, right? Like, we're only going to learn more over time. So while
I hope so.
that's the goal, at least. But what we tell people is what we know at this moment. And that's all you can do, right? Like, there's no way to know what we're going to know 40 years from now. But when it comes to genetic variants, I've seen so many patients who were diagnosed as a kid or 5 or 10 years ago. And honestly, what we know about their condition has changed a lot. Sometimes it's very precise information. It's like, well, you have this mutation in a gene and we know more about that exact mutation. But other times it's broad strokes. Like in the mito community, there's a condition called LHON that primarily causes vision symptoms. There's still a lot of people that are told it only causes vision issues, but that's pretty outdated. We know it can affect other parts of your body as well. But a lot of people, if they never go back to see a genetic counselor or see anyone in genetics, they just follow with their neurologist or in that case, their ophthalmologist, that info can get missed because there's nobody that's actually going back and checking and going, well, what did we tell you before? What do we know now? And does that change how we treat or manage you? How you talk to people in your family? Maybe you thought it couldn't get passed down and now you find out it could or vice versa. But also things like clinical trials. Are there trials you can get involved in? Do we need to do more genetic testing before that? What does that seem like? So there's a lot of different ways in which you can touch base with a GC afterwards. Family planning, research, additional testing, or just plain updates. Do we know anything new?
I think you hit on it. Like, you're not the needle woman. You're not the doctor involved. You are really a counselor. And I think that's a key word in what you do. It's bringing knowledge, it's bringing current knowledge, and it's also counseling in terms of family planning and family history and all of that. Now, let's say you do get a genetic diagnosis. Would there ever be a reason to recheck anything?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the short answer is probably not. But the longer answer is longer. So typically your genes don't change, right? Like a lot of our DNA we talk about, you've had it since you were born, you'll have it your whole life. So we don't expect to run spell check on the same gene and suddenly find different spelling change than we had before. But we do learn more about genetics. So sometimes people actually have more than one condition. I've seen people where they were diagnosed with one thing when they were younger, but then new symptoms popped up and they're like, you know, we can't say for sure if that's connected. So,
for example,
I have a retinal change that popped up recently. It's probably mito related, but my ophthalmologist I saw was like, do you want to do a retinal panel? Because we can't prove it's connected. Let's make sure you don't have something else going on here too. I said thanks, but no thanks. But like, that's an example of when you might consider it. The other thing is sometimes technology does improve in terms of like mitochondrial DNA. You can have different levels of that in your blood. Like you can have a mutation that's seen in 10% of the DNA sampled versus 20 versus 40. We've gotten better at looking for smaller changes over time. Sometimes you can have patients where, let's say that it was your kid with a mitochondrial DNA change. And they tested you as the mom and they didn't see it. So they said it was a new change in the kid for the first time, but that was 20 years ago. Technology today can pick up smaller percentages. So maybe we retest mom now and we find out, oh, it actually is in some of your DNA. So we told you before your other kids aren't at risk. And now we're like, well, maybe we shouldn't have been so confident when we said that. There is that potential. And that you can have that even in inherited variants. They call it mosaicism, where one gene has it in your body, but it's not every cell. Again, it's not common, but I've seen that pop up where we told a parent, parents were negative, you never have to think about it again. And we're like, well, we know more about that. So let's have a more nuanced conversation. So often we don't bother repeating the testing, but we do change a lot of what we say about it is often what we do. Because it is expensive. It is hard to get insurance to approve something twice. But sometimes we'll say, hey, we were very confident before. And now we say, look, often this is what happens, but we know about these exceptions to the rule. Let's talk about what that could mean for your family.
So do you see patients, and does a GC in general continually see their patients? Like, do you follow them for decades? Like, I feel like I'm missing a link in my care team, you know, and I'm learning so much.
Yeah, it really depends, honestly. So genetic counselors, we can work in a clinic. So, right. So like a lot of families that see a mito doctor through like a mito care network center, right? Like CHOP, for example, is the one a lot of people talk about. There, often all the doctors are kind of working together with the genetic counselors in there. So you'll see a doctor and the GC will come in at every visit, talk about testing, see if you have questions, update family tree, stuff like that. So often if you're in one of those care centers, you see your doctor every year or every other year, often they'll have the GC check in at a lot of those appointments. Or if you bring up a question, they'll pull them into the room so you can talk about it. I personally don't work in one of those care centers. And so for me, I work mostly as an independent genetic counselor. And so typically I don't always see patients every single year because they're going to their neurologist or their mito doctor for treatment management every year. But they'll check in with me if new symptoms pop up, being like, hey, do I need to do anything differently? They'll come back to me if they're deciding to have kids. They're like, well, before I was focused on me, now I'm family planning. What does that mean? Or sometimes they'll come back because we didn't find answers before. We had a variant of uncertain significance. And so they're like, hey, it's been 3 years. Do we know anything more about that now?
That could create a different story. Yeah. So do you see patients in person and virtually? I'm just curious. And are there a lot of GCs that do that?
Yeah, so I am fully remote personally, though I do partner with some hospitals, the company I work for. So I've had some of my patients will be in person, but I'm not. So I work at a pregnancy center. So they'll go in for the ultrasound and then talk to me. So they're there, but I'm not.
Yeah.
Because we support different hospitals that are in different areas that sometimes it's harder to get genetic counselors at or to get them. And so we kind of do a little different than most people. But for a lot of people, the GC is in the building with you. They're popping in or they're supporting a clinic. And so they'll have them call you or they'll have them come in on a, like, telehealth appointment. Yeah. So there's pretty much every version of it that you can think of exists. Some GCs work for labs. Some GCs work in your doctor's office. Some are independent. Some support them, but you don't ever talk to them in person. They just call you to go over stuff. We do a lot of different things. I laugh that sometimes we're like all the movement in the background. We're tracking order, we're dealing with insurance, we're taking all the family history, but people are like, I don't know what you look like, but I've talked to you 10 times. I'm like, sorry.
Are most GCs licensed to talk to people outside of their state?
It really varies. I am licensed in like 11 states, and then there's half the states that don't even have licensure. So we can see patients.
But
it's weird with jumping through legal hoops in terms of if I can't order testing, but I can still see them.
So yeah.
But it really depends. A lot of GCs, if you work at a hospital setting, you're just seeing patients at your hospital.
Yeah.
So you need to get licensed outside your state.
Right, right.
But especially during COVID, those lines got a little blurred where some of the big centers had some of their providers get licensed in neighboring states. So that if I like ordered the test while you were at my hospital, but then you drive 3 hours home, I can still provide counseling over Zoom to you and you don't have to drive all the way back. There was a little bit more of that happening. I hope it continues to happen because I think for a conversation, you don't have to drive 3 hours and deal with traffic and book a hotel and get...
Especially when that's exhausting for our population.
Exactly. And it's just also not fair. Like,
yeah.
Taking off of work, spending all this time.
Right.
If you don't need to do a physical exam, why bother? But again, if you're coming in to see the doctor who needs to do an exam, it's easy to tack a GC onto it. But when it's just me, I'm like, please don't drive anywhere just for me. Like,
Well, I always want to think about the person that is in Philadelphia and can go to CHAP, or the person that's in a rural area and has a difficult time. I want to make sure that the information we provide feels accessible for both, you know? So there are GCs that they could be followed by outside of the big centers.
Exactly. There's GCs that you can find that do telehealth or that are at your local hospitals. A lot of children's and adults hospitals have GCs. Again, since this is the Mito audience, your local hospital might only have a prenatal and a cancer one. And so if your doctor refers you over to the, you know, genetic counselor at your local hospital, they might go, I only do cancer, or I only do babies. I don't know anything about this. So sometimes you do have to dig for telehealth genetic counselors like me. But there's actually, if you Google find a genetic counselor, it's literally findageneticcounselor.org. Like, and I'm not surprised. Right? Yeah. So you just Google find a genetic counselor and it'll pop it up, and you can put in your region, telehealth, in person, and even like specialty like cancer, prenatal, adult, et cetera. And it'll sort them out for you, and you can reach out. A lot of people email me that way. That's how we get a lot of patients, is people are like, I found you on this website. Can you help? And I'm like, I need more than that one sentence. Tell me about why you're coming.
I get it. So switching gears a little bit, do you think that the Mito population with a found genetic diagnosis, with a found genetic mutation, the diagnosis, do you think that population is growing within the Mito community?
Yeah, I do. I think it's hard. Depends on how you define growing. Let me put
it. Yeah, that's a good point.
Are there more people getting access to genetic testing and finding their answer when before they kind of just got stuck, especially if they live somewhere rural?
Yes. Yeah.
Right? I think the good news is more insurances are covering genetic testing, more Medicaid. We're arguing, and the labs are arguing, to get whole exome and testing approved for Medicaid patients. So more and more, like, I was a baby with failure to thrive. I just went home. Nowadays, they would actually do genetic testing on little baby me, and probably would have found an answer a lot sooner. So I think that population is really growing. But also, I think, so if we're talking like total number, yes, it's growing. If we're talking percentage of the community, it's a harder question, because I think we're still a little stuck in the path of often people who have, quote unquote, the classic features like MELOS or MRF get diagnosed easier. And so I think we still do have a group of people who find their way to our community, and it's very straightforward. Like, they saw the doctor, the doctor's like, you have this, and it was easy. But for most of us, it's a complicated journey. And so I think we are finding more people that find their way to Mito, think, I think this fits me well, but then either can't get to genetic testing or their testing's inconclusive. So I think our population is growing, and the percent of people in that population who aren't 100% sure if they have Mito or not is a bigger and bigger percentage. Because of Google, people are able to actually find this answer, when before, the only way you knew what Mito was is if your doctor brought it up.
Right.
It's kind of hard, because I think it does change the dynamic when you go to conferences. Most people you talk to are like, well, what type of Mito do you have? And they're like, I don't know. When you went 10 years ago or 20 years ago, most people had an answer of, I have this one or I have that.
So let's switch gears. Let's talk about that part of the population. So I went to my first mitochondrial disease-related conference this past, or in 2024. And I was astonished that there were so many sporadic cases, and also cases where they didn't have a genetic finding. I thought that I'd be in the norm, in the majority, where, you know, I have a genetic diagnosis and my family's been ripped apart from this disease. So I thought, that's how you think always, you know, that what you've gone through is probably the norm, you know?
It's also the textbook, though. Like, you are the textbook. Like, that's right. What doctors learn about is,
oh, yay.
I
wish I would be in a different textbook, but it is what it is, right?
So, like, if you Google it, you're going to find stuff about that matches your story.
Yeah.
Because that's kind of the textbook approach.
Right. So, I met all these people that had enough confidence in the fact that they have a mitochondrial disease that they were to come to a conference, but they don't have a diagnosis. And there were sessions for specific types of diagnosis. I don't know what they did during that time, but it really made me think about this group of people.
Yeah, no, it's a hard place to end up, I think. I think
it's really scary.
Yeah.
It's very uncertain. I mean, I feel uncertain even with a diagnosis, you know? And I really feel for this segment of our population. You seem like a good person to talk to, like to better understand why this happens.
Yeah, so it's complicated why it happens. The answer to everything is it's complicated, right? If only life was easy. But I think we touched a little bit on it in a previous talk where we talked about how the definition of what mito is has changed over time. And that is part of that here, where we used to do muscle biopsies to diagnose it often. And we used to say, if the muscle biopsy was abnormal, you have mito. And they used to say, like, I have complex 1 deficiency. I have complex 2. That was based off of the testing in the muscle. And we're like, oh, this is low. That's your diagnosis. And then we realized muscle testing can be abnormal for lots of other conditions or other reasons. The most common example right now people hear about in the news is long COVID can cause mitochondrial dysfunction and could cause abnormal complex testing. But is that really mitochondrial disease? No, it's long COVID with mitochondrial dysfunction. And so I think as that shift has happened, it's part of why you see the shift in the population too, is you just found the super obvious cases first. Like, you have MELAS, you have KSS. And then it turned into the group of people who have muscle biopsy diagnoses, and they had different, I have this complex, I have that. And then genetic testing really started becoming the norm. And we would do like whole exome or whole genome, and we look at as many DNA changes as we can, and we look at mitochondrial DNA and the DNA you get from both parents. And we still only find an answer for 30 to 40% of people who kind of meet the, we think it's probably mito bucket.
So that's really where it's at, about 30 to 40%.
It depends on what study you look at, because it depends on their criteria. Because, right, there was a clinical criteria that they had, and they stopped using it, where they said, if you check these boxes, we think you have probable mito. But it was just not super helpful because there were so many other muscular dystrophies and stuff that overlapped enough and people were getting mislabeled. And so right now, I say 30 to 40%. There are some studies where it appears higher because they're more selective of who they did the testing on, like who did they consider probable mito.
That makes sense.
And I've seen it lower where you include just every patient who comes in going, it could be mito, and then you do testing and it's not quite 30 to 40%. But by default, that means if we took everybody who had those abnormal muscle biopsies who were told you have mito, we're leaving over half of them behind with genetic testing, right? Like 30 to 40% means that we're telling 70% of the population that falls in this bucket that they might not actually have this or that they don't have this. It depends on which doctor you ask. But they actually had a paper that said stop labeling people probable mito because it made their doctors stop looking for other answers. But from the patient side, you're like, well, I'm going to stick with probably mito because it fits and I meet other people who get it. And
yeah,
I don't want to go from probable mito to no one has any idea what the heck's going on, because that's not a fun box either. And they're like, look, if you find out it's not mito later, I'll pivot. These are my people. They get it.
Yeah.
Our symptoms, the supplements help.
Yeah.
I'm going to stick with
you can base people. Your care team around that.
And so it's this hard position to be in, because some doctors are like, well, you can't come to a mito center unless your genetic testing's positive. Other doctors are like, I'm fine labeling many people as probable mito, but then you go to a different doctor who doesn't agree, and then your doctors disagree. And where does that leave you? Because that's not fair either to the patient. And it's just a hot mess. It honestly is when you're stuck in that bucket, because you get labeled doctor shopping if you go around to different providers. You can spend a lot of money out of pocket on genetic testing because the first test was normal, but you still want answers. So sometimes people then order tests for themselves online, like the direct-to-consumer ones.
Are those as accurate?
Not even close.
Okay.
They are gibberish nonsense.
Really?
Not spend your money on
Don't spend your money on them. Okay.
It's hard because what do we mean when we say something's genetic? Do we mean that it's running in your family, or do we mean that we can find a genetic answer? Many families, like patients, view it as the first bucket. They're like, look, half my family has this. This must be genetic. Or me and my brother both have it. It must be genetic. But then when testing's normal, the doctor's like, it's not genetic. And they're like, but it obviously is. What are you talking about? People in my family have this. And so then they do more testing to try to find that proof. But it's not that it's not an answer in a gene. It's probably that the technology or the knowledge isn't there yet to find it. And so you're stuck waiting. And waiting sucks. Like, I'm just going to be blunt. Like, being told your kid is really, really sick, but we have no more testing to do to get them an answer.
So we're going to slap a probable label on it.
Or no label and just give you the random symptoms like your kid's in heart failure, but we don't know why they are, and then send you home. And I mean, honestly, with mito, having a label doesn't often change your treatment. It's still whack-a-mole for all the symptoms as they pop up, to be totally honest. But it can be so much harder to get taken seriously by different doctors. And I don't blame anyone for wanting to spend money on online testing or keep going to different doctors who are willing to do more invasive tests, like trying to find that answer.
Yeah.
That's a totally normal human response mm-hmm. to having your body fall apart or your family member's body fall apart with no answers, no solutions, and no timeline or next steps of when we might be able to get you that. It's just, it's hard. And if you don't qualify for a quote-unquote primary mito diagnosis, we don't find a genetic answer, the genetic center in your area might not want to see you. Mito specialty center might not be able to see you. You probably can't get into clinical trials because those need to know what type of mito you have, because they have to be able to correlate how well
for
you
sure.
do something. So mm-hmm. if they don't know what you have, if you do really well on the drug and the other people in the trial don't, they don't have a reason of, well, this is why. And so then the data is not helpful.
From what I understand, it's so hard to get a large enough population for a drug trial. So what a catch-22.
It really is. And honestly, they started with broad stroke studies where they tried to include anyone who could possibly be mito. And their data was just so messy that it didn't work. And so now they're kind of forced to take the opposite approach of, I don't know if we can get enough people, but we need to get people who have the most nailed down everything that we can figure out. But it's hard because then they add other stuff, like, because you have to be able to do the study. And so they'll be like, well, you have to have confirmed mito. You have to be in this age range. You can't be like on hospice or have heart failure, and you have to be able to walk, but you can't walk too well, you know? And it's like, wonder why they can't find anyone. But it's because they're trying to do things right. And that's the hard part. Like, they're frustrated too. They wish that they could include more people, but they're trying to be as perfect as humanly possible so that we have to do the fewest number of trials so we can get things approved and actually get treatments to people's doors. But on the flip side, the patients are like, I don't care if you proved if it works or not, I'll take it. Like, I just need anything. Just give me the drugs. And that's also a totally valid approach, right? Like, if your symptoms are going downhill fast, you're like, yeah, I'll take the drug. I don't care if it works.
That happened to me where I was starting my first trial and a friend looked at me and she was like, maybe I've even told this story on a podcast, but she looked at me and was like, you're just going to like put that drug that's not approved in your body? And I'm like, yeah, because I don't have any other options. So we're going to go with it. I had never even given it a second thought.
Exactly. I'm starting a drug soon. And it's totally experimental. Never tried in a mito patient before. And yeah, I talked to another mito person about it. And they were the only person that ever said to me, like, what? Why are you? You don't need to be a guinea pig. And I was like, all my other mito friends' response was, dude, you're so lucky. And that's what I feel. I feel beyond privileged that I have an option of trying a treatment, because I just assumed I'd never have any treatments in my whole life.
Yeah.
Maybe that's pessimistic of me, but like, I feel so lucky.
Mm-hmm.
But other people are, yeah, they look like you have a second head when you say that. They're like, what do you mean you just want to take the fun drug and see what happens? I'm like, well, it's not like a drug off the street. It's from like a good drug company. Like,
there's really no one I trust more in the world than my Mito doctor. So if he's telling me to do it, then I don't know. You sometimes have to trust it from my perspective.
And again, it's just the reality of all meds. I mean, even just typical meds, right? Like antidepressants. Why do you take one versus another? It's usually not super based in science. It's like, this doctor likes this one better, so you're squirting it. So
they've seen patterns specifically for or against a drug.
But it's often their personal opinion.
Right? Yeah.
Or, you know, generic studies of who knows for sure. So like, I think a lot of medicine is an art more than a science. It can feel that way in the like decisions we make. And so I'm like, yeah, it's all an art. So let's splatter some paint and see what happens, right? Like,
that's how it feels sometimes. So let's say my diagnostic journey is done and I have not found a genetic mutation. How do you recommend advocating for yourself?
Well, first, I would say, arguably, your diagnostic journey's not done, because we don't have your answer. So I think of it as like, you're still on, some people call it the diagnostic odyssey. I jokingly call it the diagnostic purgatory, because that's how it feels. You're still stuck in the purgatory, even when you've, quote unquote, exhausted all options. But I always start by saying first, have you actually exhausted all of them? Right? So like, what genetic testing did they do? Did they do a small panel? Did they only look at mitochondrial DNA? Like, let's make sure, you know, we took the time to try to go see genetics, even if you have to travel and wait a while to get in because they have obnoxiously long wait lists, to make sure that like, yeah, we did check that box. Have you checked the metabolic box? Have you done a lot of the blood work, like amino acids and urine organic acids? And like, again, have we really thrown the nets that we can? And that can be hard to advocate for. You sometimes do have to find a really good primary care or neurologist who's willing to say, let's keep digging.
Can you order genetic tests?
As a genetic counselor, I can order genetic testing. Technically, it depends on what state. In some states where there's no licensure, I call the PCP and go, hey, I want to order this on your patient. And I explain everything. They usually go, okay, I'll co-sign. And then I order it. But usually, yeah, I'm placing the orders, I'm doing it, but I still have to know what I'm looking for.
Yeah.
Right? If someone comes in and is like, I have vision issues, but they don't know what type, I'm like, well, I don't know what test to order. But if you see ophthalmology and you come in and you're like, I have retinal dystrophy, I'm like, mm-hmm. I know what panel that is.
Because mm-hmm.
it depends on what symptoms, if we even have a panel to offer, right? Like diabetes, we know it runs in families, but for, you know, the normal older onset type 2 diabetes, it's not like there's a genetic panel for that. We know there's a genetic component, but there's not a panel I can give you. There are mito panels that exist, but I also want to make sure we're throwing a wide enough net. You can look for only mito, but if you have hearing loss and seizures, I'm going to want to throw a way wider net than mito. I want to make sure we're covering all the epilepsy conditions, all the hearing loss ones, because again, maybe you have two things going on. Maybe you have one thing that explains the hearing loss, and there's something else we need to figure out as well. So you want to make sure you've covered those bases. You also want to make sure that, you know, you've covered the clinical side of that, right? Like MRIs, blood work. There are programs that exist for undiagnosed patients, right? Like the Undiagnosed Disease Network, the UDN, is funded by the NIH for now. There's a lot of funding issues right now happening. But they have centers all over the U.S. that if you haven't been able to find an answer, you can write a letter summarizing your history. You can write a doctor has a writes a letter, or any medical professional. I've written them for patients outlining why I think there's still obviously something going on here, but we haven't been able to figure out what it is. And they review those applications and decide what patients they want to accept into their program, the ones that they think we can offer a next level of testing to try to find you an answer. And they do a whole multidisciplinary center kind of approach where you go in sometimes for a couple of days and they just do everything on you, blood work, MRIs, sometimes biopsies, more genetic testing, and they see if they can dig it up. Like, that's an option for some people. exome and genome testing, if you have that done, most labs offer free reanalysis. So it's negative today, but most of them will offer at least one relook at all the data for free. So I typically say wait at least 1 to 2 years or till you have a new symptom. So if you've never had seizures, suddenly start having seizures, that's a whole new list of genes that they should look at.
Yeah.
So you can reanalyze your exome and sometimes find the answer 2 years later because your symptoms changed or our knowledge changed. My gene, that is my answer, it wasn't on testing a decade ago. It's on some panels now. I need to check if it's on most of them. It's on my to-do list to call the lab and be like, have you added this gene yet? But like, that's how it happens. Genes get added one by one. And so someone else who has my condition could have had negative testing a decade ago.
Right.
Now could be.
That's crazy.
Because we have 20,000 genes and we know what like 5 to 8,000 of them do in terms of symptoms. That's not even half. So we know a lot. We also know very little. And that's the frustrating part because people are like, well, when should I redo it? And we're like, we can't say for sure when we'd find your answer, but rule of thumb, wait a couple years or wait till new symptoms and then try again and see what we get.
Yeah.
But it's
covered so much today.
It is a lot. I will say again, sometimes you don't know and you get stuck with probable, and some doctors will disagree with me. I think that's fine. As long as you make sure people keep looking, I don't think there's anything wrong for being part of a community of people that get it and have.
Yeah. Especially when you feel so isolated because of your health.
And also, like, how do you treat mito? You treat the symptoms.
Right. So right.
I really care if you have fatigue for a different reason than I have fatigue. We both can share in tips that help with dealing with
it. Yeah.
Like, does it matter why you can't hear? No, we all still speak sign language. Like, not we, royal we, some of my friends do. Like, again, does it matter why you have hearing loss? Sure, it's nice to find other people with the exact same type. But to be honest, it doesn't change the bonding. It doesn't change what specialists you see half the time. It doesn't change what meds and supplements and therapies you do. So in my opinion, I'm like, yes, please be part of our community. And if you find out you have something else later, which some of my friends have done, they still have a nice group of friends who know what it's like to have the same symptoms. That's not a bad thing. And then they get a bonus second community, which is awesome.
Right, right. Well, you have gone through so much information. To our listeners, I hope that there was something that you could have gotten out of that. And I have to imagine most people listening could. Thank you so much, Devin. We are a very small population and everyone in our group has a unique set of symptoms. And I think that the way you speak, it's clear you understand that. And I appreciate you. And I'm so glad that we've had you on a few times this year. And we will make plans to have you on more. We're constantly thinking of new ideas for episodes. Thank you, Devin.
Glad to help. I have the easy part, right? Like, if I can talk for an hour and that somehow really helps someone, that's amazing. Like, I would take it.
Yeah.
But it's always lovely to talk to you too. So hopefully we'll talk again soon.
Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for joining us. I encourage you to browse other Energy in Action podcast episodes. I am so inspired by the resilience of those in previous episodes, and I know you will be too.